And our special guest tonight, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, will be back with her in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Talk about vaccines, if we can, this hour. Are you opposed to every vaccine out there?
I really don't feel that they're necessary, George. I feel that the risk of the disease is much lower than the risk of the vaccine. And through the 7,500 hours of research that I've done over the last 6 years, you know, my position on that has gotten stronger and stronger as the years have gone by. It's like each year that I put in more and more information, and I spend 2 to 3 hours almost every day researching that, I just feel that we are causing immune system disruption, leading to more infection, more problems, kids being sicker and sicker and sicker, because now, the numbers are just staggering. I mean, as recently as 1985, kids got 33 vaccines by the time they started kindergarten. And now with the introduction of the influenza vaccine starting at 6 months of age for babies and to be given annually for the rest of their lives, kids now get more than 100 vaccines and about 30 shots by the time they start kindergarten.
And I'm sure I got my share of them when I was a kid. And I've always wondered, sometimes you never know if it's going to affect you or not long term. You know, but one of the problems, Sherry, is schools, for example, school districts scare the heck out of parents by basically telling them, your kid's not going to be allowed in school without immunizations. And this is beyond the religious objection. So what do you do if you don't want to give your kids vaccinations, but the school district is compelling you to?
I am so glad you brought that up, because I think it's one of the most important questions that parents need to have the answer to that is just not generally known, is the exemptions that every state have for the right to refuse vaccines for your kids to get into the public school system. Every state has a medical exemption, which can be a little bit hard to get in terms of getting your kids into school, because the medical exemption usually comes for a particular vaccine after you've had a particular problem. But there are more and more doctors that are willing to write exemption letters if your children are chronically ill. That's every state. Every state except West Virginia and Mississippi have religious exemptions to where that you can write the letter in a certain way to say that I really believe that introducing viruses, bacteria, and toxic chemicals into my body is not allowing the God-given immune system that I have to support my own health, and I don't want that for my children. There are organizations out there that can help you write those letters. There are 16 states that have what's called a philosophical exemption, and I'm here in Ohio, and Ohio is fortunately one of those states. That means that once you get some information and you decide you don't want your children to have any more of these vaccines, all you have to do is to fill out an exemption form. Schools are required to have either an exemption form on file or a completed vaccination record, but most schools will not tell you that. And parents often ask the question, well, gee, my kids have had some of the vaccines. If I stop giving them, will that be okay? Well, certainly. And so I sort of think about, if you were beating your child and you decide to stop them, would that be okay?
Yeah.
It's like, yes, it would be perfectly fine. It doesn't harm anything. So at any point in time, if you decide that, they've had some, I feel like that gives them a little bit of protection and that's where my security is, you can stop at any time. So those exemption forms are available all across the board.
What do you do with a parent, Sherry, who may possibly be opposed to vaccines, but they're petrified of being wrong to the point where they don't want to use their kid as the experiment, basically? And they say to themselves, my God, if I don't let them get these vaccines, what if they come down with this disease? They could die. I don't want to be responsible for that. To them, maybe they think it's safer to give the kid the vaccine.
It's all about education and information, George. I mean, it really is. I mean, that's why, at the top of the hour when you said that I was going to be willing to just give away this information to your listeners, with the purchase of the book, because I feel like the education, the three-hour DVD, has all of the answers to this. And I think that once parents realize that the risk of the vaccine is there no matter what, And that once they understand the infectious processes and they're not so fearful of the disease, they'll get the understanding that the fear of, that the risk of the disease in almost all cases is less than the risk of the vaccine. The other part is that you can get the vaccine and still get sick. So you can still get measles. If you get the MMR, you can still get measles. You can still get rubella. I mean, you can get the chickenpox vaccine, which has a very high failure rate, and still get chickenpox. But then you've also assumed all the risk that goes along with getting that vaccine. And as I've found that over the years of doing this and my experience of speaking with lots of parents, not only in my own practice, but at seminars and through radio programs such as yours and others, that once parents get it and once they understand it and they can wipe out the fear, which is just like the fear-based, the stuff of the bird flu that we've been talking about, once they understand it, they can eliminate the fear. They don't feel like it's such a risky proposition anymore.
What is the general flu season? How long does it last?
It generally there's two answers to that question. One is, when is the flu vaccine season? And the other is, when is the flu season? The flu vaccine season, they start really pushing the vaccine around August or September, because that's when the vaccine becomes available. And that's when I think they're really going to start pushing the bird flu, is when the vaccine becomes available. And it's probably going to be next fall. So they start pushing that because they want you to have the shot anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks to develop an antibody level, supposedly to protect you before the flu season kicks in. The flu season, really, technically, the way we think about it, starts about December and goes through about March. Now, my take on that is that what we have really when the flu season comes is we really have Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas, where the kids get pounds and pounds and pounds of sugar between Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas, and then the flu starts around January, February. And I think that people's immune systems are so shut down by the horrible stuff that they're eating, just because it's socially acceptable to do during those times of year, that their resistance is down. They're in closed areas. Most of us living in North America, you know, it's winter time and we're all inside and all that other stuff. So I think that that's really kind of what happens.
So the flu season technically is over with for this season, right?
Yes. Another thing about the flu that I think is the flu shot, just the general garden variety flu shot that I think is really important, is in the last year, since September of last year, the Cochrane Collaboration, which is a international consortium of scientists who do systematic reviews of research data on a particular subject, they have done three reviews on the flu shot, one about the elderly, one about normal healthy adults being vaccinated, and about children ages 6 to 23 months for which the flu shot is now being recommended. They do this research, for example, when they looked at the information on children, they looked at 51 studies that involved more than 260,000 kids, and even had 17 of the papers they were reviewing. The papers had been written in Russian. They had them translated so they could evaluate the data. And at the end of that data, they said that there is very little evidence that to mandate vaccination of babies. There's been no safety studies done and no research that it proves it's effective. And the results were equally as dismal for adults. When they looked at studies that involved more than 60,000 people, only 6% of the people that were vaccinated had a reduced number of influenza and only decreased the amount of missed work days by 0.16 days on average.
How come we have heard minimal about the flu season this year from the CDC or anybody else? All they've been talking about is the bird flu.
That's why. They're busy. They've got other things on their mind right now.
So the other one doesn't exist anymore, right?
Well, no.
The normal flu is gone, huh?
Well, it doesn't exist. It's not that it doesn't exist. It's just, you know, they've got the fear-mongering, propaganda machine going in the other direction. But, you know, over the last couple of years, they've been putting things in place to get us ready for this mandatory vaccination possibility that, you know, I hope we can spend a little bit more time on, because they've laid the background for that and they've got people all in revved up about getting their annual flu shot. And I really think that they're going to push for this pandemic flu shot as soon as it's technically available through the research.
You think they'll compel us through law to get it?
It's the background of that has already been laid, George, and that's what one of the pieces that I think is really frightening to me is that Vaccine mandates are passed on a state-by-state level. So what's required in Ohio for schools and things like that is different than what might be required in Missouri or Idaho. But so that's what's happening on a state level. But as of 2002, with the Bioterrorism Act of 2002, when that was signed into law in June 12th of 2002, the language changed in there a lot about what people can be mandatorily quarantined, which people can be examined for diseases, which people can be determined to be infected. In fact, previously, only those reasonably thought to be infected could be quarantined. Now, with the new language, it said a person can be mandatorily confined if he is in a pre-communicable stage of disease and would likely cause a public health emergency and be transmitted to other individuals. I mean, that's sort of like if you walk down the street and you have a sneeze or a cough and maybe a fever, and they're already saying, well, bird flu's around. They say, well, you might have that. We need to take you aside and examine you.
Yeah, they take you away.
They do. And there have been two other executive orders signed by President Bush, one in April of 2003, which is Executive Order 13295, that added SARS to the list of diseases that could be contained by quarantine. The definition of SARS was intentionally left vague at the request of the CDC, and it says, quote, a disease associated with fever, signs and symptoms of pneumonia, respiratory illnesses, and transmitted from person to person by cough and sneeze, and could have public health consequences. Well, doesn't that sound like garden variety flu or a cold or bronchitis to you?
I've never had the flu vaccine, by the way, Sherry, and I never will.
Well, that's good, because now they're talking about with the next executive order that with that same executive order, the keys to the kingdom, or the reins of the pony, so to speak, has been handed directly to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, that person can now decide that a disease is serious enough to arrange for the apprehension and examination of a person reasonably believed to be infected. And they can issue a directive for someone to be quarantined under suspicion of exposure and the possibility he may become sick. That comes right out of the language of the executive order.
Well, let's talk for a moment about some possibilities. Let's say we know that somebody is in this country and he has Ebola. What's wrong with us picking him up and putting him in quarantine?
There's probably nothing wrong with that, but here's with something as serious as Ebola. But here's the point, is that most people that are really seriously sick, they self-quarantine. They're not out walking around the street trying to make everybody sick. They're in bed.
with a flu and fever.
Exactly.
Well, I know where you're coming from, because I agree. Our rights are being whittled away. And they're doing all this under the auspices of some disease. I think they've got a bigger picture here. I don't think they want to just, you know, quarantine people because they don't take vaccines. I think they want to make money.
Well, I think that's part of it. And one of my thoughts is, because I've been asked this question before, is, well, do you see, Sherry, Dr. Tenpenny, do you see people going from door to door to door with little syringes and vials and making everybody roll up their sleeves and get their vaccine? I don't. I mean, the manpower and the amount of coordination it would take to do something like that. I mean, look at the disasters we had at Katrina, just trying to provide normal health care, you know, and not being able to do the administrative things that need to be done with that. My concern is that there may be something more along the enforcement arms of what happens if you don't have the vaccine. And could this be the introduction of the national ID card that shows people that you have to be able to get on an airplane or maybe to renew your driver's license or something like that, that you have to show proof of vaccination?
You may be right. Do you remember the Model States Health Powers Act, which did not pass, but it could have, which would have mandated quarantines and vaccinations?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was what that was all about. I mean, that came out in October of 2001. In fact, we talked about that on your show. And I think that because of it, of you announcing that and us discussing that on your show, that we were able to shut down that legislation. I really credit you for that, George. I really do.
Thanks, Sherry. I credit you, too, for bringing it to our attention.
But I think that that is something that all those legislation, even though that legislation didn't get passed, it's stuck in a drawer somewhere. They can pull it out whenever they want.
Well, I'm wondering if under the brand new revised Patriot Act, if they have any provisions like that. I don't know. Have you checked into that?
I have, and not that I've seen directly. But what is really more on the horizon really is the thing that I've seen that you're aware of, and I know your listeners are aware of that Division E, that FRIST addendum that was added in December of 2005, that says that the health Secretary of Health and Human Services can make a determination that the disease is a public health emergency and can recommend the administration of one or more covered countermeasures, which includes vaccination. Now, he can recommend it at a federal level. I mean, you know, the last little vestiges of our constitutional rights hanging around saying that that state rights can still supersede federal rights. But most people don't know that. And I'm really concerned that it's because of the fear that they've laid out here over the last year or two, that as soon as the vaccine becomes available and the first episode of H5N1 that's diagnosed in the United States, the fear machine will go into high gear and everybody will be running to the local health department.
Oh, my God. They'll line up.
I know. I know. And we need to let them know not to do that because the vaccine is going to be just awful. and they have no liability. The pharmaceutical companies have complete liability protection. And if you get injured from that vaccine, you're not going to have any recourse.
What do you tell a doctor who says, Dr. Tenpenny, come on now, vaccines are good for people? What do you tell them?
I tell them that I used to think that too. Many years ago, before I started doing this research and before I started investigating it myself, because that was what I was taught in medical school. And like many things that you're told over and over and over again, and there's so many things that you have to learn in medical school, there's only so many things you can investigate. And it's a 200-year story that's been told over and over again, so you don't take the time to go and look at it. None of us did. I said a million times, George, that when I was working in the emergency department as a board-certified ER doc, I used to give away tetanus shots like they were some special kind of candy. I never even looked in the PDR, in the physician's desk reference, not even one time, to see what was in a tetanus shot and could it possibly cause any side effects or reactions.
What is in a tetanus shot, by the way? Now I'm curious. What's in that thing?
Well, there's some tetanus. I always thought it was just some tetanus toxoid and a little saline. But like with all of the other vaccines, I mean, there's formaldehyde. There's the polysorbate 80, which is a detergent. There's Triton X100, which is a detergent. I mean, there's a whole litany of other types of chemicals that are in those shots that can cause a lot of problems. I never bothered to look because I just thought vaccines were safe, effective, they could do no harm, they didn't hurt you, and if a little was good, a lot was better. Well, you know, all these years of research and reading the documents from the Centers for Disease Control, reading the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal, doing thousands of hours of research, I know better now. And doctors just don't know any better. They haven't taken the time to do it. But I will say that many of them that have watched my DVD, either on their own initiative or because maybe one of their patients said, please take a look at this. I know personally many physicians who no longer push vaccines. I have several pediatrician friends who've given up their practices and don't even practice in their regular practices anymore because they won't give vaccines to kids.
Well, there's no question. I mean, remember the Chiron situation last year where they had contaminated vaccines for the flu?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that could happen anytime, any day, especially with, how could they come up with a bird flu vaccine when they don't really even have a human form of it other than the 100 that died? But, I mean, it really hasn't mutated yet.
No, and that's what I say, and I talk about that a lot in the book, the fact that they don't even know what the right virus is. And, you know, you can't have it both ways, George. You can't say, on the one hand, in order for the vaccine to be effective, we need to have an exact match, which is what they tell us every year about the flu shot and why they change those antigens every year. And they say that it's a different strain. And because it's a different strain, then that's why you have to have a flu shot every year in order for it to match. That's been the the marching orders about the flu shot for years. And now they're saying, well, if we get sort of a close match about the pandemic vaccine and that virus, you know, it's going to be close enough and it'll give us some protection. I mean, you can't have it both ways.
Let's talk about the agenda of the globalists and how this all ties together when we come back. Hey, if you're interested in our upcoming book, Worker in the Light, which will be officially released in September, Amazon.com is now discounting it for first-time buyers who want to order it now, and I want to pass that on to you. I just found out about that myself. So that is Amazon.com. The name of the book is called Worker in the Light by me and William Burns, B-I-R-N-E-S. And go have at it and have some fun. And again, it will not be shipped, though, until the middle of September. Sherry, what do you think the globalists' agenda is with the scare, the vaccines, and everything else?
Control. I mean, the name of the game is control. And I'm really concerned about the national ID card. I'm really concerned about the massive movement forward of the agribusiness into Southeast Asia and into China. You know, I sort of feel like, George, it's sort of like if you were standing in a room, there was 100 people standing in the room, and they were all looking over to the right-hand side of the room because there was this big red flashing light over there going H5N1, flash, 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 and everybody's looking at it. But nobody's paying a bit of attention to all the sneaky stuff going over on the left side of the room. You know, we're eliminating the independent farmers in Southeast Asia. We are installing vertically integrated industrial-grade factory farming that is just going to be rife for more and more infections. We've killed off 200 million birds worldwide as poultry. And I think, gosh, what does that do to the environment when you've buried 200 million birds into the ground? What does that do to the ground soil and the groundwater and all those things? I'm concerned about the national ID card. I'm concerned about RFID technology being potentially a part of this. It's just not looking good.
And you know what? It seems like they're throwing all of this, Sherry, into the hat at the same time. All of it.
It does, doesn't it? It's really frightening to think about. I don't know, George. I would say probably 10 years ago, I've looked at all of the things that have been going on with the globalists and the global situation probably since the early 1970s, for sure since the mid-70s, and have seen it sort of move along at a slow pace. But in the last 5 or 6 years, it's exponentially increased. And I kind of think that the agenda, and it's truly an agenda, has exponentially gone up because of the modern technologies that we now have. Things like the internet. I mean, before the internet, things could happen in New York, and you didn't know about it until the next day when your newspaper came out in Los Angeles. But now you can know about it in a minute or less, seconds. And so there's all this communication. There's various activist groups that are working on all of these areas together, and they can be all over the country but be united through the power of the internet, united through the power of radio programs like yours, and people can have much more information at hand. So I think that the ability to keep all the stuff in under control is slipping away. So it's sort of coming fast and furiously from all directions.
Did the polio vaccine work when it first came out? Or was it going to be eradicated polio anyway?
Well, that's the two infections that people always talk about when they want to talk about vaccine things is, well, what about polio and what about smallpox? And the truth of the matter is that the polio epidemic was large, relatively large. They think that there were, you know, somewhere between 10 and 20,000 cases at its peak. But it went away really quickly. And there was a graph that I found on the CDC's website that actually shows the peak incidence of polio and the peak incidence of paralytic polio, which those two things are different, was more than 70% gone before the polio vaccine was introduced. So was the polio virus and whatever was causing the polio outbreak and the paralysis that was happening, would that have gone away on its own without the vaccine? Well, it looks like it was vastly on its way out. The same was true for measles. The same was true for pertussis, that most of these infectious diseases were on their way out. With smallpox, it's estimated that less than 10% of the world population ever was vaccinated for smallpox. And some of the head people from the CDC, one in particular, Dr. Tom Mack, who was very involved in the smallpox eradication program, testified at the CDC in 2001 and said, you know, smallpox was on its way out. It just was going to take a little bit longer after we instituted public health and personal hygiene into these third world countries.
Do you remember when we were younger, they used to talk about an iron lung, that some people had come down with some affliction and they'd be living in one of these things forever? How come we don't hear much about that anymore?
Well, several reasons. First of all, we don't have iron lung machines anymore. Initial version of what we have in terms of ventilators currently in the hospital, or respirators, as some people think about. That was the primitive version of it. But something interesting about the iron lung machine, George, is that I've done a lot of research in the area of the polio vaccine, and particularly the things about the iron lung machine. I know that there's one picture that we see from the 1950s. It looks like we see it everywhere where you look at polio. It looks like a hospital ward with a bunch of little incubators in it with all these people that were in these iron lung machines. I have bent over backwards to try to find how many people really were on an iron lung machine nationwide and how long were they on it. I have not been able to find any information at all. I even went to the National Medical Historical Museum in Baltimore and got into the polio archives with special permission. I mean, they would have to bring up these books with gloves and all these other things. I couldn't find anything in terms of data to say how many people were actually on iron lung machines. Now, there's no doubt that there are people that were. There's no doubt that people have residual problems from polio, even to this day. That's not to minimize the fact that people did suffer from this problem. It's just that, did we make a whole lot more out of it than what it really was in order to propagate the vaccine industry?
How did that thing work, by the way, the iron lung?
It was a negative pressure type of machine. It would put you in, and it was a negative pressure, so it was like a billows. And when the negative pressure would change, it would act like a billows to suck up on your chest wall, to make your chest wall expand, so the oxygen would go in, and then the pressure would increase, and it would be like a billows pushing down on your lung, on your chest wall, to make the oxygen go out.
I remember pictures of like a little kid in there, and they scared the heck out of us, Sherry, when they talked about getting the vaccines, because, you know, they basically said, this could be you. It was horrible. I mean, they were scaring us then.
Well, you know, you find something that works, you know. It's like make a plan and work the plan.
We've been using
a fear-based technology for a long time, and it works.
It works, so why change it? How long did people have to stay in these iron lungs? Forever?
You know, I'm not really sure. I do know that the statistics are that less than 2% of people who were ever exposed to the polio virus experienced any level of paralysis. Of those 2% that experienced paralysis, either in a limb, like a leg or an arm, of that 2%, more than 90% of those people had full recovery after 2 years. Less than 0.02% of the people who experienced paralytic polio had the bulbar polio that actually put them on an iron lung machine. So the numbers overall were extraordinarily small. I know that some people did die in an iron lung machine. My mother-in-law actually worked in a polio hospital when she was in her age, and she saw that. I have several patients who worked in polio hospitals, and a lot of them, people said that, yes, some people died, but most got better. So I'm not exactly sure how long people had to stay on that.
What do you think the next couple years will do in this country, the rest of the world, with all that's happening right now?
I'm not real clear what you're asking me.
I mean, what do you predict? What are your predictions?
In terms of the vaccines?
Everything. Disease, vaccines, everything you've worked on. What do you think is going to happen?
I think it's, like I already said, you know, make a plan and work the plan. I think that the plan is in place to transform the development of the influenza vaccine from the egg-based technology that it is now into these new cell culture vaccines, and we're going to add toxic adjuvants to it that are going to cause a whole bunch of terrible problems. I'm really concerned that the enforcement arm of mandatory vaccination will come from restrictions, sort of like sort of like with the IRS, you know, our paying our taxes is voluntary, but you know what happens to you when you don't volunteer? So I think that that could be one of the enforcement arms of the vaccination issue. You know, I've listened to your program and I've read the book Spy Chips, and I'm really concerned about the RFID technology and how that's going to play into the vaccine world and how that's just going to play into our lives in general. I'm really concerned about agribusiness and what they're doing with genetically modified foods and genetically modified grains. I'm concerned they're developing a genetically modified chicken that will only grow to market rate maybe with eating genetically modified corn. Who knows?
Without feathers.
Without feathers. And just like the cows without the legs, you know? I mean, how disgusting is that?
It is.
And so there's the whole idea of the global, multinational, chemical, pharmaceutical, agribusiness people that are just destroying our world, George. I mean, you know, when people were very unhappy with the English government, the Puritans and the Pilgrims, they could sail across the ocean and set up in a new country. We don't have another new country. We don't have another new world. We've only got this one. You know, the whole idea of going to Mars or to the moon, I mean, it's, yeah, maybe someday out there. But right now, I think that one of my premises in this book that I feel so strongly about is that what I'm trying to get people to see is that the chemical people, the pharmaceutical people, the agribusiness people, it's all one big monster. It's all one big elephant. And all of the different activist factions that are animal rights people, the anti-war people, the anti-GMO people, we all need to band together and realize that we have a lot of commonality and that if we can all join forces instead of just picking apart our little piece, it's sort of like that story of the five blind men in the room trying to describe an elephant, and they only see it from their particular view. Mm-hmm. I think if we reach out to each other and really work together to try to stop this and take back our rights, take back our food, stop the contamination of our water, I think that's the only chance that we're going to have any sort of freedoms and viability on this planet over the next generation.
This 10-point plan that you said a doctor and his wife were carting around the country, how do you know that it was geared for fear? I mean, how do you know that?
When you read it, there's no doubt. I mean, really, when you read the plan and you read specifically what they're talking about, it says start with your audiences, make common cause with the public, and let them know how horrible the pandemic is likely to be. That's step one of the plan.
And they put that in writing.
In writing. And it's in the World Health Organization magazine, and it's been all over the internet, and I've written a couple of papers about it, and it's in the book, and it's just there. I mean, once you read it, George, there's no doubt that that's what it's about.
Is there any drug out there on the market, Sherry, that you would tell somebody to comfortably take if they needed it and if their doctor prescribed it? There are some pills out there that I'm sure help people. They've been beneficial. Others have been yanked off the market as well. But I mean, is there anything you would support?
Well, drugs in and of themselves aren't intrinsically bad. But here's my take on it, is that the absence of symptoms in the presence of drugs is not health. You know, health is not the absence of symptoms in the presence of drugs. Health is the return of vitality to where you don't need those drugs anymore. Drugs can be life-saving. I mean, literally, George, if you got run over by a truck, you would want to go into an emergency room and you would want to be taken care of by the highest technology that we have in the healthcare industry, that you would not want somebody to drive you to your local massage therapist and acupuncturist. You know, drugs can be life-saving when they're used appropriately. The problem is that they are way overused. Nobody really works on the health side of the equation, figuring out what is missing from somebody's biochemistry in terms of nutrition and vitamin supplements that causes a misfire in their physiology, which eventually leads to a disease called a pathology. Nobody's really looking at that. They just look at giving a drug to treat a symptom. So I don't know that I would disagree with the statement that drugs are just all bad. I just think that drugs are overused and we need to look at health from a different paradigm.
You know, I have taken upon myself to be an experiment for the program here. I interviewed Douglas Mulhall several years ago, then did another one with him last year. He's written a book called The Calcium Bond, where some doctors now believe that the hardening of your arteries are based on calcification, in that they're taking it a step further. They believe that if you break down that calcification, which they agree with, that it then releases nanobacteria in your system. So they recommend taking tetracycline with that. Interesting. The whole program, I think, is based on an incredible science of natural nutraceuticals, the chemical EDTA, which is used in chelation therapy, and then this tetracycline. But I'm on it now, Sherry. I'm going into my third month of what could be a 6-month program. But I want to. I'll report all the results from the beginning to the end when everything's finished, to let people know how it worked, because it could be life saving. Or it could go nowhere, but we'll find out.
I think that you're doing a great thing, and good for you.
Really?
Yeah, I do. I think you're doing a great thing. I've looked at some of the nanobacteria technology, and I've also looked at, you know, and how that could be certainly causing a lot of problems. I mean, it's sort of like mycoplasma. I mean, mycoplasma is another problem that gets treated with tetracycline and goes away. I mean, drugs just aren't bad. Drugs just have to be used appropriately, and we need to be looking at what else we need to do to build up our health. We need to detoxify our systems. I mean, this whole thing that we were talking about earlier, about this whole concept with dioxin and the combination with influenza, the two together creating this big inflammatory response. Now, here's another one of my theories, is that viruses aren't intrinsically bad guys either. I mean, if your body is completely loaded with dioxin and chemicals, and you come in contact with a garden variety influenza virus that causes you to purge those chemicals by having a high fever, diarrhea, vomiting, mucus, all those things that go along with the flu, you know, burning off those sorts of things. After that's all over with, is your body in a healthier state? And do people die from influenza because their detoxification systems are clogged, their lymphatics aren't open, they're constipated, they don't drink enough water, all of those things? So, because to my knowledge, nobody has ever taken any like mucus or diarrhea or any of those sorts of things that people are experiencing when they're trying to quote unquote expel a flu virus, and measure the levels of chemical toxicities in there. Maybe the viruses and the bacteria on this planet are supposed to be symbionts with us. They're supposed to work together with us. And maybe this is a way that we can purge the body from those chemicals. And it's one more area of medicine that we got it all wrong.
You know what I find intriguing, too, is so many medical doctors are beginning to look at preventative medicine and alternative medicine in addition to their own remedies and pharmaceuticals. But they are really beginning to think, you know what, I want to cure people. I don't want to just try to react to disease. And I like that.
Well, what we have to do to make that happen, George, is we have to dismantle the germ theory of disease. I mean, we have to go back to the beginning of what that's about. The whole issue with Pasteur and Bouchamp, you know, Louis Pasteur said it's all about the bug, it's all about the virus, it's all about the bacteria, and we're just these weak little frail humans on the planet, and these bugs are going to lurch on us at any minute and cause us to be sick. Out of that, the entire pharmaceutical industry was developed in terms of antibiotics and all those sorts of things. The other school of thought was Bernard Bouchamp's thought, which was, it's not about the bug. It's about the condition and health of the body before the bug shows up. It's about something called the terrain. And if you have a healthy terrain, a healthy immune system, a healthy diet, you can be immersed in these bugs, including H5N1 and what other type of Ebola and these other viruses that are around, and nothing's going to happen to you. And on his deathbed, Pasteur recanted and said, you know what? Bouchamp was right. It really is not about the germ. The germ is nothing. The terrain is everything. But because he was dying and because the pharmaceutical industry had already taken off in a big way from there, everybody looked at that as just the musings of a dying man, and that was the end of it. But when you get to talking to conventional doctors about getting rid of the basic germ theory of disease, I mean, you better be ready to put on your boxing gloves. I mean, it can be more hostile than just talking about vaccines, and that can be pretty hostile. But
well,
in order to change the paradigm, that's what we have to do.
It's time to open up the phone lines with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.